Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hour number two of your Ben Jarofsky Show is brought to you by the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Miles Kampf Lassen, the pride and joy of In These Times, the pride and joy of Whitney Young High School, a rock and roll superstar from back in the early O's, has joined us. Miles, did you get a haircut?
Not yet. Still growing.
Not yet. Okay, it's just combed differently. Sorry about all that attention on Miles. Miles kind of like feels about when he comes to the show the way Nancy Pelosi supporters feel. Like when Nancy leaves the White House, people always comment on the dress. And Miles is like, how come you always talk about my hair, man? There's more to me than my hair, okay?
I try to, you know, much like our friends at the what I've been watching lately, the Great British Baking Show, I try to combine both style and substance. So
okay. we have,
you know, where all of us are a little bit ungroomed lately because of, you know, the situation out of our control. So, you know, I'm just letting those locks grow.
Well, let me just say this on the issue of being ungroomed. I've been unfashionably ungroomed since the early days of the Jimmy Carter administration. So I was ungroomed long before it was fashionable. All right, we got a lot to talk about with Miles. Madigan, Robin cabinet. I'm all fired up on Robin the cabinet. I don't know what Joe Biden is thinking. I actually don't even think Joe Biden's thinking of it. I think Rahm's just promoting it. The Michigan Senate victory, all kinds of things. But let's just talk about the budget in the city of Chicago a little bit, Miles. Miles covers local and national news for In These Times. We just got the breaking news. Dennis gave me Lori Lightfoot got her budget passed. I think the vote was 28-22 on the tax increase portion of the budget. And then 29-21 on the budget itself. What a joke. Some aldermen voted against the tax and then voted for the budget. This alderman, whoever it is, I don't know, must think his or her constituents are really stupid. You know, Jeanette Taylor, powerful quote denouncing the budget. Don't give me crumbs and tell me it's cake. And she was sort of speaking for a lot of people of the leftist persuasion in the city of Chicago when she said that, Miles. On the other hand, I see that Maria Haddon, Andre Vasquez, Michael Rodriguez voted for it. So what's your general thoughts on the budget that the mayor has pushed to the city council?
Miles, are you there? Ben, are you there?
I'm here. I'm waiting for Miles. I think we lost him. We're having some troubles today with the show.
There are days and there are days.
You know what? Live listeners, live stream listeners, I appreciate you sticking through this, but the podcasters, they'll never even know about this, D. You're right. But yeah, we lost Miles. I was holding back, waiting for him to answer that, but
right, I'll fill in for Miles. Well, you know, my hair is really long and, you know, it's just getting out of control. That budget, I tell you, that's crazy. But boy, I play guitar.
It was well done, man.
I'm trying.
For a second, though, that was Miles.
I'm trying.
So we're going to reach back out to Miles, see what he has to say.
No, but you're taking a look at that article there in the Sun Times. Kind of share with everybody what we're learning here, because like I said, it's just now breaking.
Yeah, it was just breaking. I noticed that this was the point I was raising with Miles. And if you really follow closely the politics of the left in the city of Chicago, three aldermen who are generally considered progressives or Democratic Socialists voted for the budget. That would be Maria Haddon of the 49th Ward on the far north side. Mike Rodriguez of the 22nd Ward in Little Village. And Andre Vasquez of the 40th Ward, which is around just west of Andersonville on the north side of Chicago. So, you know, there's... each alderman has his or her own reason. I think there's a lot of obvious wheeling and dealing behind the scenes that each alderman is trying to cut his or her own deal. Miles, are you there?
I'm back.
Oh, you sound much better. I don't know what went down, but I was asking you for your general thoughts on the budget. I noted that three progressive aldermen, Maria Haddon, Mike Rodriguez, and Andre Vasquez, voted for it, even though many of their colleagues on the left side of the council voted no. What's your general thoughts?
Yeah, I think that this was obviously this is a pretty historic budget vote in that, as you just said, the numbers. I mean, that 21 is pretty close to 26, you know, but the opposition still fell short, including by winning over some of the progressives, Maria Haddon, Mike Rodriguez, and Andre Vasquez, as you mentioned. This is, you know, a complicated time because there's a mayor who has resisted what, to say the least, a lot of the proposals put forward by progressives on the council. And yet we're in the midst of a pandemic and the city is struggling as its residents are. And there were some elements of this budget that would, you know, provide support as, you know, as you would expect from a citywide budget. I can't, you know, pathologize what they, you know, any of these particular three progressives decided, you know, what made them decide to side with the mayor on this particular vote. But I would not be shocked if they explained it by saying that, you know, they were voting for the good parts of the budget and, you know, they're going to continue to fight against the bad parts. The problem is, look, this is where the road meets the rubber, is on the actual vote through the democratic process. And this was a chance to reject another, what most, you know, I think progressive observers would call an austerity budget, a budget that asks working people in Chicago to pay more in order to make up for the financial crisis that has resulted not just from COVID, but from the fact that, you know, the corporate class in the city has gotten wealthier and wealthier as poor communities are continuing to be starved of resources, which is exactly the dynamic that this mayor said she was running against when she ran for mayor just a few months ago. So, you know, I think it's not surprising that the vote was this close. I think that the defections from the left that you named are pretty noticeable and stark. And, you know, that'll be a debate among groups that backed those candidates, I'm sure, but also about how to, like, build and get to 26, you know, because I think that that's what, especially on issues like this, that's what it comes down to, is how do you build a coalition that can actually not just not be a rubber stamp, which we saw, you know, clearly this council is not just approving everything, but able to push back and peel back some gains for working people. I mean, look at the whole issue of progressive taxation. That was hardly even talked about. We could have restored the corporate head tax in this budget. We could have included a higher, you know, tax on retail property rather than asking just, you know, regular homeowners in the city of Chicago to pay more across the board. There's all kinds of progressive measures that could have been taken that this administration resisted. So, I mean, the fight goes on, but I think you're right to point out that those are, you know, pretty surprising.
Well, it's really difficult to talk about new forms of taxation in the middle of a pandemic. And I know this because I'm feeling the effects of the pandemic hard in our own little house right here. So I know it's across the board. And to a large degree, I think this budget, as I said, is a punt, putting off tough decisions in the hopes of money coming in from Joe Biden. So I gather that. But one thing progressives have to realize, just putting aside the specificity of the situation you're in with the pandemic, is that there's clearly not close to 26 votes in the city council for a progressive budget. Because if you take a look at the aldermen who voted no, Miles, they come from different groups within the city council, different factions, and some of them would be vehemently opposed to anything remotely resembling a progressive budget. So, for instance, my good friend Raylo in the 15th Ward, I don't know if he would vote for a progressive budget. The North Side aldermen who voted no, I don't know if they would vote for a progressive budget. And the Northwest Side aldermen, I have to see exactly who voted no, but the people who had been opposed, Marty Quinn, the 13th Ward Alderman, voted no, I believe, in finance. So I don't know. I don't know how he voted today. But so I don't know if there are votes for a progressive budget. You know what I'm saying? That we could read too much into this to say that.
Yeah, well, I don't want to give too rosy of a picture. I mean, obviously, those are fights that need to be had. But those are proposals that have been put forward consistently by people like Carlos Ramirez Rosa and Rosana Rodriguez, the 35th and 33rd wards, respectively. I mean, these aren't like ideas that are coming out of nowhere. They've been discussed. And I think that the only way you see if they win is if you bring them to the floor for a vote. And instead, what this administration's done, and you know, council's done, is put all of these proposals into the Rules Committee again, where they've gone to die, much like happened under previous mayors. And I'll just say, you know, and I'll say this because this is what these folks have openly said, but you're just to put a point pin on what you were saying earlier. Nick Sposato today said he respects 96% of his colleagues, which I think was a pretty clear, you know, we could clearly ascertain what he's trying to say through that. And Brendan Riley said that he tweeted this out earlier today. He said he had to listen to so much left-wing rhetoric. He had to, you know, pull back and breathe into a bag in order to not freak out. So clearly, there's some of these longtime aldermen are getting a little triggered by all the open left-wing talk that's happening on the city council, which I think is a pretty positive development. I mean, if you listen to some of the public comments, they were, you know, from regular working people, organizers, activists, people that are facing the realities of life in Chicago as being, you know, a poor person of color, and saying, we're not going to put up with this anymore. I think that there needs to be more of that type of voice on city council. I think we haven't had it in a long time. And I think the inclusion of some open leftists on the council helps. And then also kind of because of this new arrangement, because of COVID, with the call-in into these meetings, we've been able to hear more from people on the ground that are dealing with this. And, you know, some aldermen are pretty uncomfortable with that. But I say, let's get some more of it.
And this is a perfect segue into the ROM discussion, because what you're getting at, not so much with Nick Sposato, who is pretty much a Trumpster. I haven't talked to Nick since this election, so I don't know if he did vote for Trump this time around. He did last time. So he's pretty much a Trumpster. But Brendan Riley from the 42nd Ward on the Gold Coast has been really edging toward Trump country in this last month or so. He endorsed Pat O'Brien in the run against Kim Fox for state's attorney. And now he's so upset by the rhetoric coming from the Carlos Ramirez Rosas of the world that he felt compelled to put out that tweet. So this gets at sort of the dynamics of the Democratic Party that's so symbolized by Rahm Emanuel. And Rahm, when he was mayor of the city of Chicago, had opened hatred for all things on the left. Brendan Riley seems to be drinking from Rahm's cup there. And now Rahm, now that Joe Biden was elected largely by the support, I would say, of lefties and black voters, Rahm is trying to emerge and get an appointment to the administration and the cabinet somehow or other. So any position, I think he'll take any position just to say, hey, I'm a player. What's your thoughts about this, Miles? Do you think that the left will be able to convince Joe Biden to keep Rahm Emanuel out of the cabinet? Do you think that Joe Biden will try to appease the Brendan Rileys of the world by putting Rahm in the cabinet? What's your thoughts on this?
If I had to get, well, so, I mean, my position on this, I have been pretty clear about. I actually wrote an article for In These Times that was called Keep Rahm Emanuel as Far Away from the Biden Administration as Possible, and laying out the case for that. I actually wrote a different piece that I believe is coming out soon in a publication called Jalopnik, focuses mainly on actually cars and transportation issues, but making the case specifically why he should not be transportation secretary, which is what the position he's been floated for. Now, according to Greg Hines at Cranes, he's apparently angling for or being considered for U.S. Trade Representative. I haven't heard those reports confirmed. Who knows where Greg, you know, got that idea, maybe from Rahm himself. We don't, you know, we don't know exactly where this rumor mill is beginning or ending. There's one particular issue that has really galvanized the progressive left, I'd say, across the country, and that has been keeping Rahm Emanuel out of the Biden administration, not even because of his failed record in public life, which is, you know, too long to list here, but is, you know, just been marked by trying to appease and cozy up to corporate interests and billionaires, people like Elon Musk, while just leaving working people out in the cold. We saw that throughout his time in Chicago. He never met with, you know, or listened to grassroots community organizations. Some of, you know, you and McDumkey's reporting on who Rahm was taking meetings with. It was all the, you know, business CEOs. That's who he was representing as mayor. And I think that's who he's represented throughout his career and would continue to represent in a Biden cabinet, which is why many of us don't want him involved. But the real key is his role in the Laquan McDonald scandal and being a player in this truly tragic scandal that he covered up a video, withheld video from public view of Jason Van Dyke shooting Laquan McDonald 16 times. I think that left a stain on his career that he'll carry for the rest of his life. And that's what a lot of folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Mondaire Jones, two incoming Congress people, have cited as their reason for really being opposed to Rahm's selection. The list can go on and on, and, you know, but I think that the message that this should send is, if Joe Biden does select Rahm Emanuel, it won't only be a poor choice, you know, in terms of his administration. And, you know, I think Rahm should be as far away from the levers of state power as possible, considering what he's done when he's had access to that. But it would also just send such a debilitating message to the community, the very communities and constituencies that won Joe Biden this election, and basically saying, I actually don't plan to listen to you or take you seriously at all. And I don't think that's the foot that this administration wants to start out their term in office on. I would hope it wouldn't be. You know, I mean, it's kind of fool me once, fool me twice. There was times when Obama selected, you know, when Obama selected Rahm as his chief of staff back in late 2009, or early 2009, late 2008, that people in Chicago thought, hey, maybe this means we'll get some good deals in Chicago, you know, because Rahm's, you know, Chicago guy, he's going into the administration. What happened? You know, what did Rahm do? He fought to get a lower stimulus bill, advised Barack Obama not to pursue healthcare reform, saying it was too much of a political cost. Luckily, Obama didn't listen to him. He told him not to pursue immigration reform because he said it was a third rail of American politics, which Obama did listen to him on, and got zero action on that until the Dreamer actions years later. I mean, this is somebody who just is opposed to the progressive vision that so many of us hold, and is going to fight for that whether he's education or transportation or U.S. trade representative. If he's in there, you best believe that Rahm Emanuel is going to be fighting tooth and nail to make sure that he destroys any opportunities for success for the progressive left. So I think that it's pretty clear that this is a toxic choice, and that and I don't even know. I mean, we haven't heard from Biden's people that Rahm is a key candidate. It's more been kind of media hype. And we all know that Rahm Emanuel himself is kind of a master of media hype. So I would not be shocked if he was involved in some of this rumor mill himself. But we better hope that the Biden team is smart enough to stay as far away as possible.
Yeah, that was well put. I assume that if Rahm himself is not in the cabinet, there will be someone with Rahm's worldview in that cabinet with influence to Biden. It's just that's where Biden comes from. So it's not as though you're going to completely keep out people who view the world the way Rahm Emanuel or Brendan O'Reilly view the world. It's just this particular purveyor of that view. And when you were talking, Miles, I had this flash. Let's say he is nominated for trade rep. I think that requires a Senate confirmation. I know a secretary in the cabinet does. Can you imagine if it comes before the Senate? And Republicans, man, they want to make things as bad as they can for Dems. You remember during the campaign how Donald Trump used Joe Biden's support for the crime bill in the 90s against Joe Biden in an attempt to get black voters to vote for Donald Trump. Imagine just Rahm at a Senate confirmation hearing. We might finally find out what happened with Laquan McDonald. I almost want Joe Biden to do this so I can hear a Republican interrogate Rahm on Laquan McDonald. You know how Rahm, you ask the mayor, Mayor Rahm, why did you bury the Laquan McDonald video and keep it from, under oath? He can't duck and dodge, Miles. It's
well, you just made a strong case for him to be at least thrown in front of some type of Senate committee for some reason. I hope it's not, you know, him being involved in a new administration, but I'm come right there with you that he should definitely be forced to get under oath in front of the Senate and answer some questions. I mean, look, you just brought up the crime bill. Rahm was intimately involved in passing that. He also, under Clinton, was an architect of NAFTA. He helped to write the damn legislation that fueled offshoring of jobs, that helped lead to this flatlining of wages, that basically, you know, demolished the U.S. manufacturing sector. And then welfare reform was another, you know, key point that Rahm brought to the Clinton administration, was passing through this this bill that shredded the safety net that, you know, led to a spike in extreme poverty and has widely been condemned by all factions of Democratic coalition now. So, yeah, I mean, Rahm's got a lot to answer for.
He sure does. And by the way, Rahm on immigration is no joke either, which is so funny because at some point he was trying to jump aboard that bandwagon, and he would always be talking about some relative or another of his who came to this country through Ellis Island and how much he believes in immigration. I'm like, you are something else, Rahm Emanuel.
There's a memo. People should, I mean, I don't know. I read this stuff because I'm a nerd, but in 1996, you wrote a memo to... Yes. The Clinton administration advising him to achieve a record number of deportations of what he called criminal aliens. Like, this is somebody who's, he was telling a Democrat to do this. So, like, as much as he might, you know, celebrate, not, you know, people might have, you know, come to whatever the left moments in their lives, I don't think Rahm's had that. He's just kind of triangulated and followed the political pathways he's needed to be able to retain power. So when he cheered on things like Chicago being a sanctuary city, I mean, obviously he did this when he was mayor, you know, look a little deeper, because he also told Democrats to not even touch the issue of immigration, because he referred to it as quote unquote the third rail of American politics. Well, now look, the Democratic Party relies on the Latino vote in order to win at a national level. So do you really want somebody in your administration who's been so, you know, has had so much antipathy towards the undocumented community and towards immigrants in general, that he had actually advised Democrats on a national scale when he was at the DCCC to not even talk about immigration, let alone propose legislation. So, yeah, I think that you're very right to bring up the immigration as a particularly toxic aspect of Rahm's record.
Oh, yeah. Joe Biden, I know you're a big listener of this show, and you particularly love the segments where Miles comes on. Please do yourself a huge favor. Find some other right-wing Democrat. If you got to put one on, put Brendan Riley on. The guy, he's clearly bored with being alderman of the 42nd Ward. Put him on. All right, let's
one last thing. If you're going to put, and this, if since we're sending a direct message to Joe Biden and his team, which I appreciate because they, you know, yeah, I know that they're listening. right now and every day. Hey, if you're going to do ROM, might as well just pick a Republican senator from maybe a state that has a Democratic governor and put that person in your cabinet. And, you know, that might do a little bit better for the party long term than having ROM in there. If you're going to have ROM, you might as well have a Republican. And if you're going to have a Republican, you might as well do it in a state that's going to appoint a Democratic senator. Maybe that ends up giving you control of the Senate to actually get some stuff done. Just a thought.
Well, as you said, Joe Biden is an avid listener, and Joe Biden has responded.
So this idea is a bunch of malarkey.
Oh.
Biden, it was a good idea. It was actually a very good idea. And immediately I was scrambling, trying to think of what state fits that. You know, I was trying to think, I think Louisiana. I don't know who the Republican senator is in Louisiana, John Kennedy. What can you find for him that could, hey, John Kennedy, like you have to pick a cabinet position that really has no power. You know what I'm saying? You got to put him, give him something that he can't possibly do any damage. But it's a great idea, Miles. I really like that idea.
Well, and people, I mean, Obama famously selected Ray LaHood, a Republican, to run the transportation department under his administration. So it's not unheard of, you know. And if you're trying to do this Gang of Rivals thing, at least make it politically advantageous for yourself long term.
It used to be. I'm telling you this. I've said this before. Presidents would generally try to find one cabinet position they could fill with a member of the other party. I think this ended with Trump. And you're right. It was like, so Obama put LaHood in, and his replacement, of course, didn't do him any good. Aaron Schock. So a lot of good that did Obama. But all right. Now, the big fight coming ahead, I've mentioned this several times, is the battle for the two Senate positions in Georgia. When I talk about Chicago, so much of the stimulus package that Chicago will get to quote unquote balance its budget, because let's face it, Miles, this budget is largely anticipating getting money from the feds. The state's anticipating getting money from the feds. You only get the money from the feds, really, if you have a good working relationship with the Senate. That's pretty obvious. So two really important Senate races coming up in January in Georgia. And what are the lessons that you learned from Michigan? You talked on the show many times about how you were doing volunteer work in Michigan. You were following the Michigan Senate race with Gary Peters very closely. What are some of the lessons you learned from Michigan that would help the Democrats in Georgia?
I think this is going to be the first test of this new Democratic, you know, administration, coalition. The party is in a position right now where obviously Georgia is not an ideal state to try to run the table and win two Senate races. But that said, the conditions are very ripe for there to be a rejection of what Donald Trump has, represented throughout his time in office. And also for all of the, you know, Trump MAGA people to have some type of a protest outcry that ends up undermining the actual Republican Senate candidates in the state. So on one level, I think that there's a chance that this, both of these races will see some of the Republicans eating their own. We've started to see the beginnings of some of that already on the Democratic side. Now, there's been some pretty encouraging news, I'd say, about at least what the Democrats are planning to do. I believe it was BuzzFeed had a story this past week about some of the efforts of the local grassroots groups across the state there that are aligned with Stacey Abrams' larger project about, you know, signing up new voters, but also fighting for voting rights and building up democratic institutions in across the state to help provide more turnout. I think as we've seen, Georgia is a state that just voted for Joe Biden. Actually, one of the few areas where Democrats had a House pickup was, I think it was in the suburbs of Atlanta, a House race that Democrats won. So there's opportunities for Democrats to succeed in the state, but it's going to come down to base turnout. And I think that that's what we're seeing on the, you know, and so that just means like less persuasion, right? More getting people to, who already would support a Democratic agenda to actually show up and vote. Because as we know, in this country, it's about half of people just don't vote. And in poor communities, especially communities of color, that ratio is more, as magnified, unfortunately. So the work that some of these groups are doing is door-to-door canvassing. And we have a pandemic that is rapidly raging across the country. It's incredibly serious. And I understand reticence to do that type of in-person voter engagement. But Republicans did it. Across, you know, for months they've been doing it ahead of the election. And while we saw record turnout and Joe Biden won this election by, you know, he won over 80 million votes, the most ever, Donald Trump also won a lot more than he won in 2016. It looks like about 74 million right now. There needs to, the Republicans succeeded in bringing out their base. They just didn't have enough votes because Democrats, you know, did better. But we can't just rely on that dynamic to lead to victories in that state for in these Senate races. So I think that means using all the tools at the disposal. There's ways to safely canvas and do door-to-door work that these groups, I think, are showing. You know, if somebody shows up at the door, if they show up to somebody's door and somebody answers and isn't wearing a mask, they just leave literature and say thanks, goodbye. You know, it's, so I think that there's a real effort to try to mitigate some of the harmful possibilities of COVID spread during this canvassing work. But I encourage people, you know, if you care about this, donate to some of these groups that are doing this work. I mean, obviously you can donate to the candidates themselves. But this is such a critical juncture, and who would have thought, you know, that the future of so many of these progressive proposals that have been pushed by not just like the Bernie wing of the party, but by Biden's team itself, are dependent on what happens in early January. So yeah, I think that this is going to be a real test of whether Democrats have their act together and can come out with wins. I think it's quite possible. Look at these Republicans. Loeffler and Perdue are both of them were implicated in this scam of hearing. They were in this closed door, you know, profiled or classified hearing in I think January, maybe early February, about the threat of COVID spreading across the U.S. And both of them then immediately went to their investment team and, you know, moved all their stocks around to make millions and millions of dollars while openly, publicly still denying that COVID was even a threat. You know, this is not just insider trading. That's just like, how can you be allowed in public office if you have, you know, done that? So I think it's not like these two are incredibly popular Republicans. They could be unseated, but Democrats need to actually turn out the base, and they need to treat this as the, you know, really massive test that it is for them. They'll be aided by, I mean, kind of teased at this earlier, but these Republicans are wiling out down there going after. I mean, you've got Roger Stone, pardoned by Trump, who now had this like dormant super PAC that he is using to try to get Trump supporters to write in Trump's name, even though on the ballot that is printed in Georgia, there's no space to write in names, but whatever. They're just saying write it in anyway. Rather than voting for Loeffler or Perdue, the Republican candidates, in order to send a message saying that they're not doing enough to stand with dear leader Trump in his efforts to do a coup and steal the election. You know, so there's a lot of this, and Roger Stone is not the only one. There's this whole movement of MAGA people trying to influence the Republican election and get them to protest the Republican establishment by either not showing up or voting against Perdue and Loeffler. And I think that, you know, it speaks to this broader poisoning of the well that the Republican Party has done. They already said that both Brian Kemp and the Secretary of State there, the Republican, that they held a fraudulent election. So, you know, why would that make Republicans then want to turn out to vote if they think it's all you know, a fraud in the first place. So, yeah, so I think there's plenty of opportunities for Democrats. That said, it's Georgia. It's going to be tough, but there's a chance.
Yeah, it's and it's funny that the way the dynamics are playing out here. We talk so much about the divisions in the Democratic Party with Rahm Emanuel and the Brendan Rileys against the Carlos Ramirez Rosas, that kind of thing. And now we have the divisions within the Republican Party. And I just am shaking my head. You were the one who told me. I did not realize that you told me this, that Roger Stone had been operating like this. I haven't had an opportunity to track it down because I've been on the show. But I've been following that campaign, and the rhetoric out of Purdue and Loeffler, particularly Loeffler, Kelly Loeffler, have been so extreme, MAGA, that it's like, what are they? What are they supposed to do? I mean, I'm happy. There's a split, and don't get me wrong, you know. And maybe Donald Trump has decided it's in his best political interest not to have a Republican majority in the Senate for whatever reason. I don't know.
I kind of use it as a bargaining chip. I mean, this the group is called the Committee for American Sovereignty, which is already kind of troubling. Aren't we already sovereign? But they say, quote, if we can do this, meaning write in Trump's name and, you know, get Purdue and Loeffler to lose, we have a real chance at getting these rhino senators, meaning Republicans in name only, to act on the illegitimate and corrupt election presided over by a Democrat party that is invested in the communist takeover of our great nation. So that's the pitch to vote against the Republicans in
wow,
by the MAGA Roger Stone world. So I don't know. It's beyond 12 dimensional chess. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know. It is beyond. Yeah, I just can't figure that one out. But I'll say this again. Some really important, serious issues, putting aside your ideological differences in a Democratic Party. If the state of Illinois, if the city of Chicago, if other states and other cities are going to get assistance from the feds, if the restaurant industry is going to get assistance from the feds, if every single industry that's hanging on by a thread in the middle of this pandemic is going to get assistance from the feds, I think it's pretty obvious the Dems have to win in Georgia, because Mitch McConnell has shown no interest whatsoever, Miles, in having any kind of legitimate negotiation. It's not the Republican Party of George, even George W. Bush at the end of his administration when we're heading into a recession. So, yeah, I don't know what game of chess they are playing, but if it leads to a Democratic victory in Georgia, I'll take it. I'll take what I can get at this time. All right, before we let you go, I got to get your thoughts on a topic having nothing to do with politics, but one that's near and dear to my heart. And people may not realize this, but Miles Konfleson's a huge Chicago Bulls fan, bleeds Bulls red. And so Dennis was very critical of the Bulls for drafting Patrick Williams. He said it was the single dumbest move he's ever seen in his entire life.
Well, that's fake news.
We had a discussion on this. I just want to see if the doctor was paying attention. But he was mildly critical of it. And so what's your thoughts about the Bulls taking a 19-year-old unheralded freshman from I think he I don't even think he was starting on his college team. So what's your thoughts on taking Patrick Williams?
It's a risk. I think that there's the Chicago Bulls as an organization have been understandably and I think deservingly like widely mocked, criticized, critiqued for years and years. And it really culminated under the guidance of John Paxson and Gar Forman. And it really culminated this past year with the All-Star game. You remember it was held in Chicago. We didn't have any players. The team was just going through complete you know, meltdown at that, that time. We can't say it, you know, any nicer than that. And it was a mess. It was embarrassment. You know, it was just like, what is this? This is the NBA team that this city, this storied franchise that, you know, won six championships with Michael Jordan in the 1990s. This is what we're, you know, putting forward on the national stage when we're hosting this international event of the All-Star Game. Just so sad. So, the fact we moved on in just a matter of a few months from that state of affairs to now having a new general manager, new vice president of basketball operations, whole new kind of front office staff and everything. They haven't coached a single game of basketball. And a new coach, of course, with Billy Donovan. Jimbo is gone, who was widely you know, rumored to be the single Trump-supporting professional basketball coach in the NBA. I don't know if that's true, but that's, you know, that's what the word is. But Jimbo's gone. Jim Boylan is gone. We've got a new coach. A lot of people just want to put faith in the new leadership. Karnisovas, is that decent pronunciation? AK, as I like to call him.
Yeah.
People have a lot of faith. It's kind of a black box what's going on at the Advocate Center right now. It's like, is this, are they, you know, do they have something up their sleeve? Are they going to do some crazy trade or something? We just don't know. There's no, there's nothing to go on with this crew. But it will be, as it seems likely, if they keep the current roster set, it'll just be a grand experiment of like how terrible of a coach was Jim Boylan.
Yeah.
You know, are they going to be that much better with just moving a couple pieces around, but not actually changing the core at all? I'm really interested in why Dennis is so anti Patrick Williams, though. I got to get, you know, because I just don't know. I don't know enough about him.
Dennis, defend your position.
I'm not so anti Patrick Williams, but it is like you had the number four pick and you took a gamble. You know what I mean? Not your average number four pick. You know what I mean? But also, you didn't have March Madness. You really don't know a lot about these players, I guess. You know what I mean? So I don't know. Maybe they know something that we don't.
I just think that there's like in us not having to deal with the Ball family at all now in Chicago. For me, LaMelo might have been better overall, but and I'm glad we don't have to deal with any of that crap. So,
all right. Well, you know, I put it this way. We're in the middle of a pandemic, so I'm looking forward to basketball to help me get through my new fire pit to help me get through and various movies to help me get through. So I welcome the
we're all making it through. And look, this is it. We're training camps just a few weeks away.
Yeah.
We've had a Bears team that's turned out to not be as quite as excellent as we, you know, initially maybe hoped. So, so they're crap. So, I mean, we got to have something to look forward to. City politics, things aren't going.
City politics. And I always find that entertaining. That'll get me through any pandemic, city politics. All right, Miles Konflassen from In These Times, thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving to you and your family. I don't know how you're going to be celebrating it, if you're going to be in isolation in a phone booth, the way that Gavin Newsom wants everybody other than himself to be. But I want you to have a great Thanksgiving. Stay safe and sound. We'll talk to you real soon, all right?
Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours, to everybody. Always a pleasure to talk to both you and Dr. D, and talk soon.
All right, that's the great Miles Konflassen.
Go Dolphins, buddy. Go Dolphins. Yeah!
I love the Dolphin sound, man. Only in the Ben Jarofsky Show, the Dolphin sound.
Yeah,
you Miles Konflassen, what a great guy.
You're not hearing the Dolphin on Al Franken, all right? Just saying.
All right. I want to thank Miles Konflassen, the pride and joy of Whitney Young High School, and In These Times. Outstanding job, as he always does. And, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, the pride and joy of all Illinois, without whom the show would be possible, the man that Miles calls Dr. D. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everyone.
This little light of mine. This little light of mine.
That's correct.
This little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine.